It's the Arcade Armageddon edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, Nature's Poisonous Pharmacy, TAM Preview, and video games, are they ruining the world? Let's start episode 119.
This is Eric.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free-thinking historian.
And this is Don, your apologetic philosopher of political science. We were going to play the theme to Portal 2, but someone, I won't mention Ethan's name, forgot to check to see whether there was a commercial at the beginning of that particular...
You can't check that on YouTube. Thank you.
Okay.
But, we'll get some time later in the show. We'll plug that in for you because it is an awesome song. As we said, today's topic is going to be all about video games, but also a few other things as well, right, Don?
Yes. Actually, we got an email a while ago from one of our listeners who pointed about a lecture given by a British-Irish doctor. And it was all about nature and herbalism medicine. So I thought about one of the naturalistic fallacies, that plants are nature's pharmacy. Naturalists are those who participate or practice herbalism, often make the claim that nature is our pharmacy, a pitch line often used by Big Pharma as well, that natural remedies have been provided by plants that are much safer than those created by chemical laboratories. This, as most of you'll know, is one of the naturalist fallacies. First, I'm not going to deny that there are a number of chemicals created by plants that have beneficial properties for medicine, such as penicillin or aspirin, for example. What I am addressing is the bifurcated claim that these remedies are in some way created for us, and that they are somehow safer or better than the man-made chemicals. This issue was directly addressed earlier this year in a speech given by Dr. Henry Oakley, the Garden Fellow at London's Royal College of Physicians, at the opening of the Dublin's Medical Gardens at Trinity College. He's actually responsible for a herbalist a garden that's responsible for growing medically important plants. And he was doing the speech, and he raised a few eyebrows when he stated that plants have been trying to kill us, not cure us. When asked why herbalism has been persistent over the past 3,000 years, he responded, because they believe in tooth fairies. They have no concept of illness or chemistry or biochemistry. They believe all plants have been put on earth by the Creator for mankind's use. So if the plants have a particular shape, it indicates the Creator had put it there on the planet for a particular use. Now, I mentioned that current research uses similar terminology as the quote-unquote ancients, nature is a pharmacy. However, the methodology that they use is completely different. Herbalists believe that the power that be they gods or spirits, whatever, left clues as the intended purpose of the plant, and that the herbalist's job is to sort of decipher these clues. Sometimes, of course, they're lucky. Ginseng kind of looks like a human and has been interpreted to be a symbol of divine harmony on earth between man and nature. And coincidentally, ginseng does actually have a few important compounds for things like reproduction, blood clotting, and a few other positive effects that have been shown. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's ridiculous. For example, it was, sadly still is believed, that ground tiger penis in soup is actually a way to increase a man's virility. Sometimes, of course, it's dangerous. For example, blue liverwort was once cultivated as a liver tonic because its three-lobed leaves mirrored the shape of the human liver. However, this tonic was actually, in fact, a toxin that produced jaundice. More commonly seen, if you look in your market shelves these days, aloe vera juice has been known to cause stomach cramps and even is a suspected carcinogen. And let's not forget, of course, that cocaine, caffeine, hemlock, tobacco, and pot are all natural herbs. However, most plant material is actually quite inert, and if they provide any benefit at all, it's purely as a placebo. And even that effect can be quite dangerous if it delays proper medical treatment. Now, to be fair to herbalism, it's not completely limited to this sympathetic magic sort of view. Over the years, with a certain degree of trial and error, an advancement of type has been happening over this simple symbolic notion. Certain chemical compounds have been found to be somewhat useful. However, because they actually lacked the ability to extract these compounds, they're actually mixed in with a stew of other chemicals found in the plant. And if we continue with our pharmacy sort of metaphor, Herbalistic medicine is kind of like taking a handful of random pills in an effort to get the one pill that's also an aspirin. Going back to Oakley, he says, herbalists say that things are pure and don't have the same side effects as something like Prozac, but they do have side effects. The problem is that herbal medicine, there is no long-term proper checks on the side effects. That thousands of years of herbalism has produced very little in medical knowledge. Oakley also goes on, the basic concept that most people have missed is that many of these plants are poisonous. We just have found ways to use the poison in plants in an advantageous way. This, I think, lies at the heart of the naturalist fallacy of herbalism. It's not that they are not useful chemicals to be found in nature, but these chemicals were never intended to be medicinal. The term used as nature's pharmacy could actually be more accurately described as a chemical armory, a cornucopia of chemical weapons we extract as a kind of chemical waste product and retask for useful roles for humanity. The chemicals we extract fall into really three basic groups. There are those that the plant has intended for its own health. Chemicals are compounds that the plant used to promote its own growth or whatever, and just coincidentally happen to be useful for us. For example, salicylic acid or aspirin. There are those compounds it creates to make the plant more attractive to animals for the purpose of either seed dispersal or, in the rare occasions, for plant predators, such as nectar, fruit, aromatics. The last category, and ironically the one we've found most useful, are those that are intended to attack. Compounds that the plant used to fend off funguses like penicillin or terpenes, to make them unfit for animal consumption, opium or capsaicin. But none of these actually have been intended for human use, and none of them are innately safer for human use than man-made chemicals. In fact, the exact opposite can be said to be true. Current research done extracting the chemicals, they then take the chemicals, they test the properties and their interactions, attempt to tweak the chemistry to remove these side effects, and strengthen the desired properties. Once this is done, the purer form of the active ingredient, stripped of all the superfluous chemicals, is then released as an actual drug, and it's no longer an herb, it actually becomes a drug. And it puts side by side with the sort of chemical soup that you get in herbalistic medicine, it's almost innately safer than what you would be getting from man-made. So, I don't know, herbalism seems to be not good.
Well, doesn't it raise the question that we're talking about a medical practice that was commonplace back when the four humors were our dominant theory of how to fix people?
Exactly. Or again, you know, the four humors in Western medicine, Chinese medicine is much more complex, but just as, how we put it, ill-found or philosophically founded, with very little, you know, analogous to human practices. Now, it is true, and I tried to make that clear, that herbalisms have gained some degree of practical knowledge.
Sure, of course.
I mean, giving herbs out over thousands of years, you're going to gain some things. But none of it is really, not lacking the scientific method and lacking the actual tools and equipment we now have. There were very strong limits placed on what they can actually accomplish. I mean, it's not coincidental that we've had a birth of medical miracles in the last 200-300 years, and that we also had the Industrial Revolution. It's not the industry has done it, but just our ability to manipulate chemicals, to separate and purify the chemicals, and then do a rational sort of analysis of it. Any culture could have done it in history if they had the tools. But they just lacked the tools.
Sure, absolutely. You know what, Don? As you were enlightening us about the naturalistic fallacy, I was thinking it'd be great to have a song that could go along with our great conversation. What do you say that we try that song thing again
here
on Radio Freethinker? Let's give that a shot, folks.
Remember when you tried to kill me twice? Oh, how we laughed and laughed, except I wasn't laughing. Under the circumstances, I've been shockingly nice. You want your freedom to begin. That's what I'm counting on. I used to want you. Now little Carolyn is in view too. One day they woke me up so I could live forever. It's such a shame the same will never happen to you. You got your choice.
Time ago, in a city far, far away,
CITR
was born. In the decade ahead, America will be in space.
CITR
is already there. Astronaut Neil Armstrong had this to say about
CITR.
It's one small step for man.
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Herbert R. Tarlick, Chairman.
Become a friend of CITR and receive great discounts at businesses around Vancouver. Your Friends of CITR card will net you discounts on Commercial Drive at Audio Pile, Bone Rattle Music, High Life Records, and the People's Co-op Bookstore. You'll also save online at Band March Canada and Big Mama. It pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or visit us online at citr.ca.
Welcome back to Radio Free Thinker. Let's go to our interview now with DJ Grothy of the JREF to talk about TAM 9. Joining us now on Radio Free Thinker is the president of the James Randi Educational Foundation, DJ Grothy. Welcome to the show, DJ.
Well, thanks for having me on, Ethan.
So let's start things off by getting a bit of background on you. Tell us a bit about your history with skeptical activism.
Let's see, I started in this skepticism racket right out of, during grad school, but my origins and interest in skepticism go back to well before even when I was an evangelical Christian. As a teenager, I was a magician, a professional magician, and of course there's the overlap between magic and skepticism. So I was always interested in applying critical thinking to certain paranormal claims. It just so happened for a big chunk of my life that skepticism did not also equally apply to religious claims, in that I was devoutly religious. I went away to Bible college. And when I was at Bible college, I became more skeptical of religious claims. Then in grad school, got involved with the Center for Inquiry. I know you're plugged into that great outfit. Worked with them for 10 years, eventually ending up as vice president and director of their outreach programs. And about a year and a half ago, I transitioned over to the Randi Foundation and have been loving that since as well.
And what can you tell us about the JREF in terms of skeptical activism? What sort of things do you guys like to do as outreach for skeptical groups across North America?
Well, as background for your listeners, of course, the James Randi Educational Foundation is a nonprofit educational foundation founded by the social critic and the magician James Randi, someone I looked up to as a magician when I was a teenager, not really seeing him also as this leading figure in skepticism. So I knew him first as a magician. It's a great honor for me now to be working with him kind of arm-in-arm in terms of advancing skepticism and critical thinking in society. Our organization works to advance critical thinking and skepticism about all sorts of untested and, I think, irresponsible claims in society. So, you know, supernatural and paranormal claims, you know, ghosts and UFOs, cryptozoology, some folks call SCAM or CAM, complementary and alternative medicine. Some people call it so-called complementary and alternative medicine, SCAM, in other words. These are things outside the bounds of science, but nonetheless, they're things that a lot of people believe, sometimes even to a really harmful extent. That's what riles us up. That's our mission, to confront these sorts of irresponsible claims in society, and we do it in a number of ways. You mentioned grassroots groups. Well, we provide support and resources to a growing network of skeptical organizations throughout North America, even around the world. We just hired Brian Thompson, who is heading up our field operations, supporting these local skeptics groups. We engage in digital outreach, so not only to the local groups that meet once a month or once a week for skeptics in the pub or a meetup, but sort of the sort of stuff that happens online. So we have a really robust digital outreach program, including e-publishing. We're coming out with a number of classic books of skepticism and critical thinking for the iPad and the Kindle. We support podcasts such as The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe and For Good Reason, which I host, and you know, some of your listeners may be familiar with the 200-plus episodes of Point of Inquiry I hosted. So we also try to distribute top-notch video programming online for free, mostly coming from our amazing meetings we put on every year. In fact, now they've grown worldwide. We do them in London and in Australia as well. One thing I'm really excited about when you're talking about the grassroots is this regional skeptics program, this workshops program that we started a little over a year ago. We've so far done regional workshops through local groups in cities like St. Louis and Chicago and Louisville, and these cities we focused on dowsing, not on religion and atheism and stuff, but on dowsing. Believe it or not, a lot of people buy into those supernatural claims, but we think of it as a perfect gateway into larger questions of critical thinking as well. Additional support for local groups include our Speakers Bureau. This is a listing of speakers we either make available to local groups or help underwrite events at local groups. So basically speakers, experts on skeptical topics that speak around the country. Over the past year, we've sent speakers to events in dozens of cities, in states like New Hampshire, Florida, Nebraska, Georgia, California, Florida, New York, on and on. Even up in Canada, British Columbia, we've supported local events as well. And I'm happy to say that later this year, James Randi is going to embark on a Canadian speaking tour. So I'm really excited about that. That gives a kind of snapshot of the sorts of things the JREF's interested in supporting, both at the local level and digitally online and through our other educational programs. We've only scratched the surface, though, because there's a ton more. You know, the JREF in the classroom program, the resources we provide to school teachers, our grants and scholarships, on and on. But that's a kind of a thumbnail sketch for you, Ethan.
Right. And tell us about the upcoming conference, TAM9.
Well, the amazing meeting, TAM, is the biggest conference of its kind in the world, and it's one we've been putting on in Las Vegas for a number of years now, and now also, as I mentioned, in London and Australia. The one we just did last fall in London had 900-plus people in attendance. It was actually amazing, like it's named. The Australian TAM was a great success, too. It was just written up online. We had over 1,300 people last July in Vegas, and we think we're going to have about 1,500 people this July. These conferences are where loads of leading thinkers and celebrities and people interested in advancing science and critical thinking in society. They headline at our conferences, and last year, just like this year, Richard Dawkins is a featured speaker. This year we also have Neil deGrasse Tyson. It's literally 4 days, four full days of programming. We have Bill Nye, the science guy, some of your listeners may be familiar with, or the magicians Penn and Teller, Adam Savage from TV's Mythbusters, social scientists, psychologists like Elizabeth Loftus or Carol Tavris. Of course, the amazing one, James Randi, is prominent at these events. And people can get information on our upcoming amazing meeting at amazingmeeting.com. We think it's going to sell out. It has not sold out just yet. There are still some spaces left. So any of your listeners who are interested can go to the website, get more information. I'm really happy to announce that our MC this year is the inimitable George Crabb. And so I think that's going to be a blast, a lot of fun for the four full days of conference programming.
Excellent. And you mentioned that great speaker list. How did you guys decide who to bring in? And was there anyone that you wanted to be there but you just couldn't get?
There were two speakers that we really worked on. And one, in fact, I guess because of the nature of this anecdote, I can't identify her, but one who agreed beforehand that she'd be able to come, and then because of a schedule conflict or whatever happened, she had to bow out. We hope to have her next year. In addition to which, Anne Dreen, Carl Sagan's widow, the science writer in her own right, great kind of leading advocate for the reality-based view of the world, we really wanted her to be on the program this year as well. She can't because of a scheduling conflict, but hopefully she'll be able to join us next year. When you look at the TAM program, it's really the leading lights of science and skepticism, really some science superstars, Neil deGrasse Tyson, for instance. When we're building the program, we ask ourselves a question, who out there in the popular media or in science education or in culture, who is saying what the JREF wants everyone to hear? And then we appeal to their good graces to join us at this conference. And we're happy to say that really, in the history of TAM, the leading thinkers, leading personalities, and some of the most interesting people on this gosh darn planet have very graciously joined us at TAM.
And this is the second TAM that you've been president of the JREF for. How's the learning curve been between conferences? Is there anything that you're doing differently this time?
That's a good question. So my 10 years or so at the Center for Inquiry, I was involved in putting on a number of conferences. So it's the same sort of skill set. One thing we're having to do differently this year as opposed to last year is just dealing with the problem of capacity. So the hotel is already sold out for hotel nights because we've far exceeded our expanded room allotment, kind of our room bank for this year. We've gotten some other hotels in the area to hold some rooms for us so more people can attend TAM. It's a good problem to have when your event gets so popular that you're running out of room, but nonetheless, it's a problem. So that's one thing we're having to make some adjustments about this year, in addition to which we've really expanded the program. So we have 10 workshops this year. A few years ago, I think there were just two or four. So we have workshops this year for attendees on UFOs or defending evolution in the classroom, investigating monster mysteries, or workshops on science-based medicine. We have a kind of how-to workshop on paranormal investigation. We have kind of grassroots training and organizing workshops for educators and doing activism online as a skeptic. So all of these workshops, including workshops for parents, how to kind of inculcate the skeptical spirit in your children, or workshops for people who want to explore the relationship between spirituality and skepticism. Well, shoehorning 10 robust workshops into the program when before there was far fewer in number, that's been a challenge. But we think we've hit just the right balance of great value for people who come to TAM. We haven't raised the price the past few years for regular registration, but we're offering considerably more conference for folks. We think we've just struck the perfect balance so people get a lot of value, and then there's still some, call it downtime, so people can experience what I think is the most valuable part of TAM, which is, can I call it a kind of family reunion, where people get to see their best friends in skepticism. It's kind of the skeptic movement's annual conclave, right? People come together and I use the phrase family reunion. I really think that's a valuable aspect of TAM that we really want to make sure there's time for this year and every year going forward. That's one of the most heartening things about the skeptics movement to me, that it's welcoming, that it's not just a bunch of sourpuss fuddy-duddies who get together and argue about what they don't believe in. Instead, it's affirmative, it's positive, and people get together, and frankly, we all love on one another, and it's a kind of secular, skeptical community where we're all getting together in community, talking about how we can make this world a better place. That's inspiring to me.
Well, it sounds awesome, and I'm looking forward to it. I hope many of our listeners get a chance to go to TAM9. It's a wonderful experience. And DJ, thanks for joining us on Radio Freethinker. Please join us again in the future, and all the best luck with the JREF.
My pleasure. Thanks so much, Ethan.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
The state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting like more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a crowd. Draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Brendan Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver. CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
And we're back on Radio Freethinker here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
It's quite exciting about TAM coming up. You're going to TAM, are you not?
I'm going to TAM.
And from what I understand, when you're going to TAM, we may have the opportunity to do a few interviews with some people, as yet unknown.
Well, we have a few ideas of who we're hoping to talk with, but if any listeners want to take a look at the TAM speaker list and send us some questions about what we should ask them, they can email us at, no, not our old email address, but our new email address, info@radiofreethinker.com.
Ooh, what was that email address again, Ethan?
It was info@radiofreethinker.com.
Wow, that's so professional. Like,
it is, isn't it?
We got a gold star.
We do. We always get gold stars. We're awesome. But let's talk about video games, because they're awesome too. Or are they? Or are they, in fact, dangerous and lead to violent things?
Well, you know, I've heard rumors of people being killed by playing video games, that it creates a psychosis in your brain.
Well, you know what? I heard an interesting urban legend, and I thought it would be a good way to start our discussion on video games. And this is an urban legend about a video arcade called Polybius. That's right. The legend goes that an arcade game called Polybius was installed in a few arcades in Oregon in the 1980s. Supposedly, every week, some men in black would show up and download the game data. Stories spread that kids who played the game started to go insane and committed suicide. Mysteriously, Polybius vanished from arcades, never to be seen again.
Was that an episode of The X-Files? And did they make a movie, Last Starfighter, or something around this whole same premise?
Possibly. Although, Polybius did make some appearances in pop culture. There's an episode of The Simpsons where Bart's walking through an arcade and you see Polybius in the background. Mm-hmm. So obviously this is not true. The game may be related to a very similar a game by Atari called The Tempest, except that according to legend, Polybius had sort of Pac-Man-like mazes and logic puzzles. And supposedly, kids who played the game began to experience side effects like nausea and sleep disruption and aversion to video games. In addition, you had this whole sort of notion of the Men in Black coming in to collect information, which sort of made it sound like a kind of weird CIA experiment or something. Now, this is all rumors and legends. There's very little evidence for any of this. There's a few old photos, but most of them are suspect now because people tend to Photoshop them, and they actually build their own Polybius machines because it's now an internet meme, and people want to, you know, play around with it.
You know, in an odd sort of way, too, you know, maybe not quite Men in Black, but there is this thing called market research, where they may actually be interested in the gaming activities of particular people and go in and actually retrieve information about how the game was played, not for some evil, sinister means, but just because maybe they're trying to develop the next great, I don't know, Portal game?
Sure. And it turns out that back in the 80s, the U.S. Army actually did ask Atari to create a simulator to train soldiers. Now, this was for the military, not for public consumption, but maybe that's a possible origin of this rumor. In addition, the game Tempest actually had a few glitches that caused photosensitive epilepsy. So it had like some flashing lights on it and kids got sick. So there is, I guess, some source to this whole rumor about this sort of sinister game. But it's actually, I think, a really good way to kind of sum up the criticisms about video games. The notion that they're bad for behavior, you know, kids becoming antisocial or causing crime, and the notion that they're bad for your health or like seizures or mental illness or something like that. And I think you can kind of classify criticism of video games into roughly two main categories. Are video games psychologically or sociologically dangerous? You know, addiction, antisocial behavior, that sort of thing. And also, do video games encourage violent behavior or crime itself?
But sorry, before you even go there, you know, when you say do they inspire violent behavior, that has to be a relativistic term as compared to what? Right? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, that's a good point, right? I mean, how are they encouraging the violent behavior? How is it manifesting itself? We'll get into that as we go through this conversation here. Now, I want to address some of the sort of health effects first, and starting with sort of antisocial behavior, mainly because I think a lot of the same criticisms were labeled at, you know, rock music, rap music, and heavy metal when it first came out. You know, it was, oh, this music's going to warp your brain and everything like that. So a lot of people kind of think that this is sort of like the older generation just not getting the kids these days.
And actually, if you look back and you do any research into this, you will find very similar, very almost mirror things about, you know, rock and roll, jazz, movies, TV are all leading to a more violent society, a more corrupt, a more isolated society.
Exactly. When video games first came out in the 1970s, which is sort of, I mean, they came out earlier actually, but this is kind of when they really took off. They were generally in arcades, and they were mostly played by young boys after school and on weekends. And then when home consoles first took off in the mid-80s, you saw this sort of dramatic shift of video games being played at home. And this is where you get the old stereotype of a nerdy kid playing Legend of Zelda with a big, thick guidebook and, you know, a 2-liter can of Mountain Dew or something in his parents' basement. Now, for some reason, this stereotype has stuck around, even though that was like 2 decades ago. And that's not how video games are played anymore.
Well, not only that. I mean, if again, recent surveys have shows that the average video game player right now is 35 in the U.S. In the U.K., it's 23. But still, I mean, we're not talking really kids dominated. I mean, the majority of people who actually play these are mid to young adults.
Yeah, and the attitude has changed as well. People nowadays will bring their Xboxes and their PlayStations over, or they'll hook their computers up, and they'll play all together. You know, arcades are virtually gone. Now you have internet cafes where people will come in and use really powerful PCs and play World of Warcraft or something online. Which is interesting because World of Warcraft, which is the most popular game in the world right now, is a massive multiplayer game where you literally play with millions of people. So this isn't an isolated, weird, little, nerdy thing. This is like a social phenomenon. People are playing with lots and lots of people. So it's not an isolating activity. It's actually a very very social activity, in my opinion.
Well, and if you think of it, too, I mean, it dramatically increases your ability to interact with people throughout the world. I mean, if you're sitting there and you live in a small town somewhere, right, you may have maybe a dozen people your own age that you can sort of interact, and you're expected to interact with people your own age. Whereas, you know, with this World of Warcraft, one, you now have literally millions of people to play with. Mm-hmm. You're sort of anonymous. There's a certain degree of protection as far as, you know, age degree and that goes. But you're also, you're experiencing other people and other cultures over this sort of common interface. And I think it's a, it actually expands one's ability to socialize quite a bit, as long as it doesn't become too obsessive, which can happen irrespective of video games.
Sure. You know, it's kind of funny because if we took outside, took away this whole video game component of this, and we're talking about football, for instance, nobody would have any problem with that because you're outside, you're doing something. But because it's sort of indoors and you're kind of a little bit isolated from the outside, it suddenly has this sort of nefarious bend to it.
Well, I remember growing up that, you know, playing D&D was considered to be nefarious and
I was
evil.
Thinking about that, too, when I was researching this. You kind of touched on sort of playing video games too much, and that's where another potential hazard comes along, and that's video game addiction. Now, what I learned, and I was surprised by this, is that it's not a recognized real condition. In fact, in 2007, the American Medical Association and the American Pediatric Association considered adding video game addiction to the next edition to the Diagnostics and Statistics Manual of Mental Disorders, which is the DSM, which is sort of the big guidebook for psychology. But they weren't satisfied that the science was conclusive, so it was rejected. Now that, I think, should give us some idea of what the scientific community considers the reality of video game addiction.
Well, you know, and I think that's good, because, I mean, some of our listeners out there will probably have heard stories. I remember a few months or maybe a year ago now of a Korean guy who literally died while playing a particular video game because he just wasn't sleeping well, he wasn't eating properly, he dehydrated. But it wasn't the video game that was doing it. And it's sort of like comparing cause and effect in a poorly way. There are people out there who are called hoarders, right? And one of the things that they hoard are things like newspapers. And it's kind of like claiming, oh, well, newspapers cause hoarding, right? I mean, you do occasionally will get some ill effects coming from people who do become overly involved in video games, but it's not so much the video game that's necessarily at the root cause of it. It's these people have addictive personalities, and this is just their drug of choice.
Yeah, and a lot of the research that has been done on video game addiction is generally regarded as incomplete at best. A lot of it is done with conflicting surveys or self-diagnosis, people being asked, are you addicted to video games? And they say yes or no. That's not really science, you know. So most people think there's really no strong evidence for that. Perhaps there will be one day, we don't know. But again, there's really not too much research done on that particular point. The big one is violence. Do video games make people more violent? Now, there's actually been a lot of research into this question, and not just in terms of video games, but also media in general. And when you're researching this, I realize that you kind of have to look at what's been said about media, movies, TV as well, because there's not quite as much on video games, but when you sort of factor in the other things as well, it does sort of build up a bit more of a stronger case. So in an article called Media Violence in the American Public, Scientific Facts versus Media Misinformation by Brad Bushman and Craig Anderson, they suggest that violence in the United States started to increase dramatically around the same time as violence in mass media started to increase. So I have a quote from this particular paper. In July 2000, six major professional societies, the American Psychological Association, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, the American Medical Association, and the American Academy of Family Physicians, and the American Psychiatric Association, signed a joint statement on the hazards of exposing children to media violence, noting that, at this time, well over 1,000 studies point overwhelmingly to a causal connection between media violence and aggressive behavior in some children. So that's, I think, nothing to sneeze at. That's an interesting statement. What I find confusing about this article is that Anderson and Bushman are basically suggesting that violence in the real world spiked as soon as the first generation of media-consuming Americans reached, you know, 1820, which was around the 1960s. Now, being a historian, I kind of think, are you sure it was that? Are you sure it wasn't the civil rights movement? Because that was pretty violent, too.
No, no. It would have, I mean, the civil rights movement was always a peaceful, I mean, Martin Luther King always emphasized peaceful nonviolence. It would be anathema that there was some sort of violence associated with the civil rights movement.
Yeah.
No?
Oh. Let's look into that for another show.
Yeah. But no, you're right. You know, and again, if you follow with this sort of mentality or this following this idea, you would expect a continually increase or at least a plateau and a continue of violence rates. But that isn't actually shown. In fact, a number of studies, especially this one that you had pointed out, shows that actually from the mid-90s, there was actually a decrease in violence rates correlation. Yeah.
And that's actually when you started to see a lot of the very sort of hyper-violent video games come onto the market. So this article, I think, is not terribly good, but it did give a few interesting points, especially the points about the sick professional societies sort of condemning media violence. I think that is something to consider. Now, the American Psychological Association also issued a statement relating to video games, and I will quote from their statement. Decades of social science research reveals the strong influence of televised violence on aggressive behavior of children and youth, and that comprehensive analysis of violent interactive video games research suggests such exposure A, increases aggressive behavior, B, increases aggressive thoughts, C, increases angry feelings, and D, decreases helpful behavior, and finally E, increases psychological arousal. Now, further, that the APA advocate for the reduction of all violence in video games and interactive media marketed to children and youth. So what they're coming at here is saying that a lot of research has been done and shows that after playing violent video games, the person feels more aggressive, more angry, and is less likely to be helpful to society.
But there's been a lot of counterpoints to these studies. Like, so the findings themselves seem to be rather consistent, true. But a lot of criticisms that are used for it are things like failure to employ a standardized, reliable, valid measure of what actually they mean by aggression or media violence. That, you know, they don't actually take into account third variables. Again, you know, are violent people violent because of the game, or is there an attraction the other way around? That if you're a violent person, you will tend to play violent more games. Again, what do they mean by aggressive acts? You know, I mean, they do try and make attempts to standardize it, but even if one study says, well, this is what we qualify as a violent act, someone making physical contact, or some people will say doing something with the malicious intent to cause harm to someone else. Well, I mean, how exactly do you quantify that particular thing?
That's my big question about this. They're saying it increases aggressive feelings. Okay, but so does traffic.
Yeah.
You know, what are they saying here? Are they saying that someone's more aggressive, they're likely to do violence? Okay, I can buy that. But, you know, a lot of times I'll be playing a video game and I'll get really frustrated. I'm like, I hate this. And then I'll go and I'll, you know, fume for a few minutes. But that doesn't mean I'm going to go punch the mailman in the face.
Well, no, and let's go back one step. You just said to yourself, well, you said to us that traffic can make you aggressive. Well, not all traffic. I mean, I'm sure there's been many times you've been driving and you've been doo-doo-doo, I'm happy. And even sometimes when traffic is slow, you know, because you have no pressing engagement or something, it doesn't bother you. But if you're sitting there and you've got 10 minutes left and you've got these other, again, confounding factors, then you do get increased aggressive feelings because of the traffic. But it's not necessarily the traffic that's doing it. And even if it is, you know, it's hard to isolate one from the other.
Exactly. That's a really big point that I think we're trying to make here in today's segment. But I do have another study that's kind of interesting, and this is also by Craig Anderson and a researcher named Karen Dill. This is a more recent study, and it's been pointed to actually a lot. If listeners are familiar, especially in the United States, Hillary Clinton has been really big on video game censorship. A lot of the studies that are getting cited in like Congress and that kind of thing are studies like this exact one I'm about to tell you about. And it's a two-part study called Video Games and Aggressive Thoughts, Feelings, and Behavior in the Laboratory and in Life. So in part one, they measured both the amount of exposure to a video game, a violent video game, and the amount of time a participant has played the video game, 3-4 hours a day, that kind of thing. They then would use these as sort of predictors on self-reported aggressive behavior and delinquency. So they would take a college student population, and then they would say, how many violent video games do you play? And they're like, oh, I play Mortal Kombat and Grand Theft Auto. How many hours of the day do you play them? Oh, 2-3 hours, whatever. Then what they would do is they would retrieve from the university the student's academic achievement level, their grade point average, and how many classes they missed. And then they would give them a questionnaire of, you know, how frustrated do you get? You know, are you easily made to be angry? That sort of thing. And they compared this, and they believed that they had a correlation between students with a poor academic standing, high levels of delinquency, aggressive behavior, and they played aggressive video games. So, okay, that's interesting. Does that correlation equal causation?
Yes.
Does it?
Well, okay, that's probably what the study's author's claim was.
Yeah, that's what they claimed. The second part of this study was kind of interesting. They had two people, they had one person play a nonviolent and a violent video game, and then they tested them on aggression levels in a fake lab experiment where they thought they were competing against another person. And the idea, sort of, it's kind of complicated, but if they would, they'd both click on a thing on the screen, and the winner, which was always them, would then play a sort of annoying sound. And they could control the duration and the loudness of the sound. So they figured if the violent video games are affecting them, they'll play the noise louder and longer than they would if it wasn't. And what they found out was that the violent video games seemed to have an impact on how loud and for how long they played this annoying sound. Now, my big point for this study is that this is priming. And I'm sure if Rob was here, he would go explain, you know, what priming is. But it's not really a mysterious phenomenon. It's when you sort of subconsciously influence someone to make a decision later on. And I've heard that you can prime people to, you know, walk really slowly if you show them pictures of old people. So I don't think this is terribly an effective study, but
And you get that way with surveys too, right? You know, if someone sits there and says, you know, are you worried about your old age? Are you worried about not having enough money to make it the end of the week? Would you support a tax cut so you had more money in your wallet? Well, because of the first two questions, you're more likely to say yes to the third one. Whereas if you sit there and you ask the very same person, you say, do you believe that government spending helps make a safe society? Do you think we should support government funding of education? Would you support an increase in taxes? They'd say, oh, yes, I would. And you get the exact opposite reaction, but because you've primed the person, you know, they will have different outlets. And I think that's exactly what you're saying here, that if they're sort of primed for violence, but how does that negate what they're saying? I mean, so they're violent act, they're primed for violence. Now, in the real world situation, they're not going to be, you know, tweaking someone's ear with a loud noise, but they're going to be smacking on their brother or going down the block and hitting their neighbor. I mean, it sounds like you're almost agreeing with them that this video games are priming people for violence.
Well, I would agree so far that a video game can prime you to be angry and aggressive or frustrated. But I don't think it has anything to do with violence. Like, I've been pretty frustrated by Super Mario Brothers. Right? That's not a violent game. I mean, it's violent in the sense that he's stomping on walking mushrooms, but it's like cartoon violence. And I don't really find myself ever motivated to hit somebody. I find myself motivated to be kind of like, I'm grumpy now for a few minutes.
Well, I think one way around this, and you've kind of hit at it, is that you've said frustrated. Mm-hmm. I used the word frustrated several times, right? Well, how many things, I mean, if I'm sitting there and let's say I'm doing homework or something, right, and I'm frustrated by the answer, well, then that means it's by this study that I might be a bit more aggressive in it, right? Mm-hmm. And if I'm a bit more aggressive, does that mean it logically follows that we should make no homework? Or if you're there's any number of things in life that make us frustrated. In fact, the whole point of games, be they video games or not, and we talked about this in an earlier episode, is to put unnecessary obstacles between us and a goal. That is the whole point of a game. Games are meant to be frustrating. That's the whole point of them. And whether you're dealing with a video game doing that or not, if the frustration factor is the thing that seems to be causing most of the aggressive behavior, then I don't see how that follows.
Yeah. I did come across another interesting study. It's a methodological review of all the research on violent media impacting violent and criminal behavior. And this is by Joan Savage of the Department of Justice, Law and Society at the American University in Washington. And I'm going to quote from her study, which in her conclusion, she states, although findings from the prospective longitudinal studies have been taken as strong evidence that viewing violence causes violent aggression, a careful reading suggests that evidence for an effect on criminal behavior is practically non-existent, and the evidence for an effect on aggression is very weak at best.
Well, yeah, no, actually, I think that that works good. In fact, in doing my own research, I mean, one of the things they keep saying is that there's a correlation between video games and violence, and that we have a society where we have increased violence. But we don't. I mean, that's one of the things that just smacks me down when I see these particular claims, be they in a number of ways. I was doing research today, and I was looking at a number of government studies, these are American studies, about violence in schools. In schools, you think, is the people where they're most potentially affected by violent video games, among other things. And you look at, what is it, number of homicides in U.S. schools in 1992 is 93, and, sorry, was 93, and it went to 1 in 2009. The juvenile arrest rates for homicide, which I grew up in a nice small town. Having a murder at school itself strikes me as atrocious, but having statistics about the number of juveniles arrested for homicide, and the numbers in 1993 were 3,284, in 2007 was 1,011. The number of students threatened or injured with a weapon at school, male students in 95 went from 11 to 10 in 2007, and females went from 6 to 5 in 2007. Bullying went as a percentage. And now this is, of course, as you get older, you tend to play more video games, right? So this was all done in 2007. And grade 6, the odds of being bullied was, people reported being bullied, was 43%. And those who were actually claimed to be injured was about 15%. By the time you get to grade 12, the number of bullying reports came down to 23%, and actual violence went down to 4%. Those students who were afraid to be at school or on their way to school, this is actually Hispanic students. It was divided up by race, but the Hispanics were the most fearful in 1995, and 21% were very fearful of going to school or going to and from school, and that dropped to 7% in 2007. And you had a similar drop for the other racial groups.
Yeah.
So you just, there doesn't seem to be this, you know, if violent video games is more prevalent in our society and it's warping our children.
We're not seeing the evidence.
That's the
big point here. Is there a causal relationship between violent video games and violence? And you know, looking at the research, I can totally understand, and I'm willing to believe that all these, you know, psychiatric and professional associations think that there could be a risk of temporary aggression. I can buy that. But I'm not seeing a link between real-world violence and violent video games, which makes me wonder, are video games just a scapegoat for the ills of society?
Well, and also, too, I mean, is there a difference between the perception of violence in our society and actual violence in our society? I mean, if you think about it, I mean, violence has been, to some degree, a part of our society forever. And in many sense, I mean, if you think back, you go back to the 50s or, you know, 200 years ago, 300 years ago, domestic violence was far more common than it is now, right? So this is violence in the household, and children were exposed to this every day, right? And I mean, so, I mean, violence being a part of society is not a new thing. In fact, one could almost make the claim that because we have, to some degree, learned to recognize that domestic violence is not okay, that bullying is not okay, that we actually almost have a certain absence of violence in our society that's almost become fetishized by society. That,
well, I would actually say to that, let's look at organized sports. And I think this is an interesting analogy, which I saw in the episode on video games that Penn and Teller did. Not that I'm suggesting that bullshit is a good source of...
No.
That's the name of the show. Not the name of the show is bullshit. Not that I'm suggesting that bullshit is a good scientific study or anything, but they made an interesting point. Soccer violence. People have been killed because they wore the wrong jersey and, you know, a soccer-crazed place. I've never heard of somebody getting shot because they were wearing a Nintendo shirt.
You haven't heard about it.
I haven't heard about it. Maybe it's happened. I've never seen it written up in the newspaper. In professional hockey, football, and soccer, there are hundreds of injuries to real players, sometimes career-ending injuries every year. In amateur sports, even at the high school level, there are major injuries. According to statistics from the Ohio State, that the most common injuries included fractures, about 10 to 36%, with football accounting for the highest injury rate. So of the 10,000 athletic exposures in football of, you know, tackling and that, there are going to be 4.61 injuries per 10,000 encounters. That's high.
Right.
And I don't see that happening in video games.
No, well, you know, it's... Again, we have this perception versus reality aspect coming into here. I mean, another thing that's made it seem worse, I mean, I mentioned before that I heard about this Korean kid who died because he just let himself go playing a video game. Well, you wouldn't have even heard about that. You know, you go back, you know, 50 years ago, because right now, every little act of violence anywhere in the world gets brought to your desktop immediately as a little news bulletin, right? I mean, mm-hmm. We have a 24-hour news cycle. We've got a whole bunch of things. So the actual number of violent crimes and that we are exposed to, as in we see, have exponentially increased just because our interconnected society has made it possible for us to be aware of them. Even if locally in our own little neighborhood, the actual number of crimes and that have gone down. And there's actually a more serious aspect to this. Anyone who's ever seen the documentary, The Power of Nightmares, will know that one of the things that politicians like to promote, and they're the ones, like you mentioned, Hillary Clinton being one who's promoting this, it's much easier to try and protect people from something they're afraid of, especially if it's something that's not really to be feared from, than to try and offer them something extra. It's much safer for me to protect you from tigers than to give you a chicken roast, right? And in the old days, politics was a lot, you know, I'm going to give you a job, I'm going to make sure you have this, I'm going to make sure you have this. Nowadays, it's not that I'm going to give you anything. It's just I'm going to protect you from this. I'm going to protect you from that. I'm going to build prisons to protect you from the unreported crimes that a famous conservative politician said recently. And I mean, I think one of the things that gets swept up into this sort of political vacuum cleaner is violent video games. Is that, yeah. You know, it's an easy target. Because, I mean, they are. Violent video games are violent by their very nature, and it's an easy target.
Yeah. Fortunately for me, I'm protected from tiger attacks, but I have a special rock that keeps me safe.
How do you know it works?
I don't see any tigers around, do you?
Oh, can I have your rock?
Well, maybe for a pretty penny. Let's go to a commercial break, and we'll come back with our skeptical highlights here on Radio Free Thinker.
You really want to know what love is?
Yeah. Yes, tell us. More than anything in the world, Ron.
Well, it's really quite simple. It's kind of like, gonna find my baby, gonna hold her tight, gonna grab some afternoon delight. My motto's always been, when it's right, why wait until the middle of a cold, dark night? When everything's a little clearer in the light of day, and we know the night is always gonna be here anyway. Thinking of you's working up my appetite. Looking forward to a little afternoon delight. Rubbing sticks and stones together, making sparks ignite. And the thought of loving you is getting so exciting. Sky rockets in flight. Afternoon delight.
Do you know what love is? I do. It's CITR Radio 101.9 FM.
You guys have it, I think.
Afternoon delight.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. It's time to wrap up the show, so let's go on to our skeptical highlights. I have an interesting one here. CFI Canada recently attended a Peter Popoff faith healing. Now, for those of you who don't know, Peter Popoff is a disgraced con artist, faith healer. He was debunked years ago by James Randi on the Johnny Carson Tonight Show, but like James Randi will commonly say, Peter Popoff is one of those unsinkable rubber ducks. No matter how many times you knock him down, somebody's always happy to believe his lies. So CFI attended and secretly filmed Popoff doing some pretty disgraceful and pretty shocking things. And you can see that online on their YouTube channel. We'll have a link to it on the webpage. Check it out if you can stomach it.
And I've got one for those people of the philosophical bent. The Philosopher's Cafe is having a discussion, a forum, by Randi MacKinnon, questioning whether we can ever precisely, exactly, perceive the same thing as another person, and even if we do, how would we ever know? This is June 17th from 10:30 to noon at the West Vancouver Memorial Library. Tickets are $5.
Excellent. And a reminder that Radio Free Thinker has a new email address if you want to get in touch with us for any reason, perhaps to comment on our topics, suggest ideas, or just to criticize us. Please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com. And, of course, visit our webpage, www.radiofreethinker.com, to read our blog. Follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. And come by and say hello to us, because we love the company.
We do.
Well, this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
And this is Don saying, minds open, eyes on. Sorry, that's eyes open, minds on.
All right, see you next week, folks, here on Radio Free Thinker.